Work moves fast. Every email, report, and proposal counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It's your one place to think, write, and finish. Grammarly's AI agents help you find natural phrasing, fine-tune tone, and confidently write wherever you work. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com.
Hey everyone, just a heads up, this is part two of a two-part episode. If you haven't already listened to Dan part one, go back and listen to that first. Thanks, and here's the show. Previously on Lived to Tell.
The bear came ripping around the corner, and it just a flash was upon us. And that's when she turned her head sideways and bit down across my face from side to side and then chewed. The doctors let me know that I was completely blind.
At this point in our story, we need to go back to long before the bear attack and introduce you to Amber.
Amber is somebody that I noticed right away. I mean, I was in my young 20s, that was she, and she very much into similar things, and yeah, she caught my eye, you know, as an attractive young person. We just kind of saw each other around. I was kind of just recently out of a long-term college relationship, wasn't really looking for that.
Yeah.
So I tried to kind of resist it, but there was like this energy, this chemistry that was kind of irresistible with Amber, and so, you know, we hung out here and there.
But eventually, they just couldn't resist each other anymore. And after seeing each other out at a concert, Amber invited Dan back to hers.
We just stayed up all, you know, most of the night just talking and getting to know each other. And I say, like, even though I was just getting to know her for the first time, it felt like somebody that I had known for lifetimes. Like,
yeah.
Deep connections and ability to relate. So it was a really powerful night.
So after circling each other for ages, that night they finally decided to be a couple. But the next day was the day Dan would be mauled by the bear.
Yeah, I had a moment of like, hey, should I ask Amber if she wants to come? And she had a moment too of like, maybe I should go. But both of us were like, I don't know, that was a pretty intense night.
Yeah.
Instead, I just gave her a hug and said, hey, I'll call you when I get off the river. Well, obviously, we didn't realize like the day that I had in store for me. Really, from that moment, I would have less than 12 hours left to see.
When Dan's family was alerted, no one knew to tell Amber what happened. So she just had this incredible night with a guy she really liked, and then he ghosted her.
How did Amber eventually find out what happened? Because it's not like she's on the emergency call list yet. So how did she find out what happened? And I'm sure she's thinking the whole time, like, what an asshole.
That's pretty much exactly it. She was just like, what a jerk. I thought this was something. I thought this was special. I thought Dan was better than this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then I guess it was the next evening, she got a call from one of her friends. And she says, hey, were you kind of like hanging out with that guy, Dan? She said, well, I just saw this on the news and, you know, told her what happened. And Amber was like, oh, my God. Like, what do I do with that?
Yeah.
You know, because here we are. It's like, you know, we hung out a little bit. We had one special night together. And now this. Like, what do I do with that? I mean, because it'd be hard just to sit at home with that, you know?
Yeah, but it's also really hard to, like, know your family has to have been called to go down to the hospital and be like, hello, may I see this man? I've been on one date with him.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. She went down to the hospital, and I don't know, you know, if she was there first or if my parents were there first, but inevitably my mom ended up seeing her and was like, who's this? And, you know, nobody knew her at that point. And so, yeah, my mom talked to her and, you know, basically asked her to leave. Totally understood when my mom, you know, kind of set that boundary. And so she would call and check in with different people, or people would call her to kind of provide updates on how I was doing or whatever. But several couple days after I was out of that medically induced coma, I was replaying all the events of the day when all of a sudden I remembered Amber. And it's like, it just hit me. Like, I hadn't even thought of it yet. But as soon as I did, I couldn't talk because I had a tracheotomy at that point in time with an oxygen tube in it, and my jaw was wired shut. And so I wrote down in a notebook, where's Amber? I think it was my brother or somebody that was there with me at the time. And he was like, oh, you want to see Amber? And I was like, yeah. So they reached out to her and invited her to come back down to the hospital. And so she did. And, you know, she came into my hospital room. You know, she describes it on wobbly legs. Yeah. And I totally understand that. I mean, I must have just looked awful, like atrocious, right? Like,
yeah.
My head was probably so swollen. It was like the size of a basketball, and it had not yet been, you know, fully surgically reconstructed. And I'm sure lots of it was still bandaged, but, and like I said, a tracheotomy. But she sort of kneels down on the ground there in front of me, puts her arms up on my legs, and we just sat for, you know, what felt like a long minute. Yeah, cause, and I was just thinking, I mean, obviously I couldn't really talk at the time, but I was just thinking too, like, this is just one of those moments in life where there are no words. There are no words for this moment. And yet I'm like, I'm a caretaker by nature. And so even for me in a moment like that, I'm always like, how do I break the ice? How do I make this more comfortable for people? Yeah, I just wrote down, to start with, I wrote down the word crazy. She's like, yeah, this is really crazy. And then I wrote down, I'm blind. And she's like, yeah, I know. I'm so sorry. And then I wrote down, I'm scared. And that was it. That was the whole interaction. She sat with me, you know, for maybe half an hour or more. I don't really know. But it was wonderful to have her there. And there were lots of reasons to be scared. But I think in that moment, like, I was scared because I just had no idea what my life would be like in the future, like, as a blind person. You know, I think the obvious thing in the room there was like, okay, like, I know we had this energy and this chemistry, this magnetism that drew us together over and over until we couldn't resist it anymore. But like, let's face it, like, that we're done. Like, you know what I mean? like this isn't a thing. Yeah. And that's okay. Like, there was no expectations or feelings about that. Obviously the whole thing, whether it's losing my eyes or the perception that I was going to lose all my autonomy and all the things that I loved, like skiing and backcountry, everything. And then this relationship, like, it was all just, it was a lot to try to take it all, understand how my life had changed and how it'd be different in the future.
Yeah. And mourning the loss of your expectations for what your life was going to be.
Yep. Yeah. And yet I wasn't even done with all the surgeries, you know? And so it's like, there's a lot of things, and I still need to just be here now and focused on making it through today.
They agreed that Dan needed to focus on healing and that they would remain friends, but not be in a relationship. Because even once he was released from the hospital in Alaska, Dan went to California for more surgery and rehab.
And then, of course, when I left, it was definitely like a little bit of like a goodbye moment. And goodbye in the sense of like, hey, I know we're going to keep in touch as friends. And, you know, I appreciate like your support, but like,
I got to figure my life out.
Exactly. Exactly. So I was in California rehabbing after my surgery, kind of living with my brother and a buddy of mine that was a caretaker, you know, still doing lots of medical appointments and therapy appointments and all this and that.
After a few months in California, Dan's brother visited Alaska and came back with bad news.
And my brother had let me know, like, hey, by the way, you know, just want to let you know, it seems like Amber might be dating somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I was really kind of struck by how that felt internally. Like, it was a little bit of a gut punch for sure.
Yeah.
Even though, like, intellectually, in my brain, I was like, yeah, no, that's fine. It totally makes sense. Like, again, like, no expectations, right? Like,
right. But then like, you're like, oh, maybe I do have some expectations.
But it didn't feel good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Time, still was like, ouch.
These expectations are news to me as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think, like, literally that same day, maybe even, like, within an hour or two. I don't know. I can try to remember. But I called her. And again, maybe I was just testing the waters. So I said, like, hey, just so you know, I heard you might be dating somebody, and I just want you to know that's totally cool.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. It's fine. Yeah. Not that you asked, but I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 100%.
I mean, the best part of the story, though, but what she said back to me was, she was like, yeah, I am. And he's already getting really sick of how much I talk about you.
Oh,
so I know. And so for me, I was just like, that was a joyful conversation where what that meant to me is just that there was some inkling of hope, right?
Yeah.
But for me, what it did was it lit a fire. And it really, again, I go back to this idea that, like, how much it supported my resiliency, how much she supported my resiliency. Like, just that sense of hope really lit a fire. And I then was like, okay, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to do all the things, right? To learn how to be a blind person, work hard at learning all the skills and learn how to use all the tools, to use, you know, computers, to use a cane, to use the guide dog, to learn how to, you know, use some Braille, to learn how to cook and clean and use bus systems to navigate and, you know, all the things. I'm going to learn how to be independent, and so that I can be somebody who can be a bit available to be in a relationship. And I also knew that I needed to keep working hard on my therapy so I could be the person that, you know, the best version of myself, so to speak.
And Dan had a lot to work through. The outdoors and his freedom to go explore was a huge part of his life.
You know, and I've lived by any measure, a very full, enriched life since then, like since 2003, right? But the impact of my disability, the impact of blindness is still very real.
Yeah.
And the impact of that trauma has had on my emotional, the way I relate and the way I interact with the world. You know, I was such a spontaneous kind of living life full throttle, always down for an adventure, you know, kind of a guy. And very lighthearted. And the trauma, the weight of it all, the weight of the grief and loss, the weight of the trauma, the impact on my nervous system, you know, it has in some ways fundamentally it changed my experience of the world and kind of who I am and how I operate, right? You know, you have your friends that I knew were going to be there regardless, like my super close friends. But then I was thinking about all those Fremens where the relationships were tied to our shared love of different activities. And just thinking about how, like, for so many of those relationships, I just knew that those relationships were done. Like, our relationships were based around doing these things together. And it's great. It's great to have friends like that, right? You know, like, hey, what are you doing today? Let's go up to this pass or that pass or, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about, yeah, the loss of some of those relationships, and it just kind of, you know, hit me in a different way than I had experienced up to that point, and became tearful, and, you know, kind of allowing myself, maybe for the first time, or maybe for the first time, I was in a space to where survival was in enough of a place to where I could allow myself to cry. And it would sort of, you know, there'd be things that would happen, right? Like one of the first times I went back to Alaska after the accident, I remember Amber picked me up at the airport. We drove up to her place. And as I got out of the truck, you know, the snow was falling. And it was like one of the first snowfalls of the year early. And I couldn't help it just because of who I was as a for diehard skier. Like my body was reacting to it with the same excitement and the same like, dude, grab your skis, let's go, you know? And then, you know, obviously the obvious thing was like, well, those Taser are gone. And so, yeah, I remember we getting kind of emotional about that too.
And Dan's brain didn't let him off the hook at night.
The other part of it was much less comfortable, much more severe, I guess. And that was like, you know, the nightmares that were constant pretty much every time I fell asleep, you know, bear dreams and other types of dreams filled with fighting for my life and survival and, you know, themes of trauma type of a thing. Yeah, themes of hopelessness and powerlessness.
When sleep becomes like an unsafe place, do you dread going to sleep?
It's a good question. I could see how you would. I don't think that was my experience, but there were certainly many nights, though, where you'd wake up from a dream and you're like, I don't want to go back to sleep. I'm not going back to sleep. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd have to get yourself up, because you knew that if you fell back asleep, you were going right back
yeah.
to that place. There was that, you know, the nightmares, and I would wake up, you know, sometimes with like full wet sheets, like fully soaking wet sheets. Like I couldn't, even if I was going to try to go back to sleep, I would have to put towels down, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other thing that I was starting to have was pretty significant panic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an extremely unpleasant thing to go through. And, you know, the first time I had a very serious panic attack, I didn't really know how to name it, you know. And so I thought I was having a serious health crisis. You know, I actually thought I was dying. But it took me, you know, quite a few panic attacks and you know, some work with a therapist to really be able to recognize that, okay, I'm okay
right now.
Like, this is what's happening. This, yes, it sucks. Yes, it's highly uncomfortable, but I will be okay.
You right. know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
It took me some time to kind of think, at least recognize that, which helps the panic attack, ironically, like, because it really feels like something's not okay. Like,
yeah.
You know? And if your mind goes there, then it just amplifies the panic attack, right?
Yeah. Like, you have no power over me, panic yeah. attack monster.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it very much does, but it's just not
even though
fatal.
It still sucks. Yeah. And the hard thing about that, so, you know, I mean, there's lots of hard things about that, but you don't get to pick and choose when and where they happen. And so, you know, that's hard. And that's one of those things. I mean, it's gotten better for me now. I mean, obviously, I'm more than 20 years out now from the bear mauling.
Mm-hmm.
But really, for the first, you know, I mean, it was really bad for the first 6 years, but really for the first 10 years, I didn't really have much control over when and where and how it manifests. And so, you know, that's all of that stuff can be kind of complicated and kind of hard. Yeah, I just had to find different ways of learning to cope. And so did go and, you know, found a good therapist and started working with the therapist. And it was really, really beneficial. We did some difficult but very important work together. And honestly, like, I was so dysregulated in my body that, and my emotions, but it's all interrelated. You basically can't trust your emotions when you're dealing with a lot of post-trauma type stuff. It's like you think you know why you're feeling what you're feeling, but you're probably wrong. It probably is because of your trauma. And so there were lots of, you know, as Amber and I started to hang out again after all of this, you know, there'd be things where I would have this idea of why I was feeling what I was feeling and it, you know, relating to Amber, whatever it was. Whether it was getting frustrated or getting mad or feeling hurt or, you know, whatever it was, feeling overwhelmed. You know, it'd be easy to sort of blame her or blame the relationship or whatever. But in reality, you know, what my therapist was helping me learn and understand is like how that was the trauma interacting with, well, whatever was going on.
We'll be right back. As he was finishing up his surgeries and rehab in California, he needed to start thinking about what was next.
You know, and it's interesting because then there comes a point, like you can work your rehabilitation, and I could and I did as like a full-time job, right?
Yeah.
But you can only do that for so long. Like rehabilitation can only go on for so long before the natural expectation is that, okay, at some point you have to figure out what's next in life after rehabilitation.
To leave the rehab nest, as it were.
I started to think about like that. And I was thinking about the work that I was doing before the bear. But basically, I was working with kids that had mental health problems and mental health challenges and helping them learn healthy ways of coping and healthy ways of living life. I couldn't really picture how that line of work was still compatible because so much of my job was driving.
Yeah.
Very driving intensive job. Thought, hey, like I can't do this type of work, but I can really picture myself being a therapist because it's very office based, you know?
Yeah.
It's very relational and conversational. And I'm sure that there's other elements, you know, that involve, you know, documentation and computers and technology, but that's all learnable stuff.
Dan also knew he was absolutely going to move back to Alaska. And back to Amber. But first, he needed to learn how to be blind.
I actually went to a school, a residential school down there for people who had lost vision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's called the Hatlin Center for the Blind. And that's where I learned basically all the skills needed for activity of daily living. And it's a 12-month program, but I was so excited to get back to Alaska and get back to my life and most importantly, get back to Amber, right?
Yeah.
That I completed that year-long program in 7 months. And while I was at that Center for the Blind, you know, we had kept in touch the whole time just as friends, but those phone calls became more and more frequent until essentially it became like a nightly thing. And we were just talking on the phone every night. And there were many nights where Amber would actually fall asleep while we were on the phone together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was clear that there was definitely something there, right?
So when Dan finally moved back to Alaska.
And so when she picks me up at the airport and we drove back up to her place, it was pretty special. And, you know, once again, we had kind of like this amazing night where it was pretty evident that we were going to, you know, we were going to have a relationship.
Yeah.
I don't think we said as much, but it was just evident, right?
Like yeah.
It didn't need to be spoken. It was just clear. But the crazy thing about the story is that I had plans to go fishing and the very next day.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I think, again, this is like me getting back on the horse. You know what
sure.
I mean? This is me being like, dude, I've got to face this.
Yeah.
I've got to go back to Alaska and get back on that river and do the things, right? Because I'm going to beat this. I'm alive. I'm going to survive. I'm going to live my best life. Because otherwise, like, what am I doing? And so anyway, my friend comes to pick me up at Amber's place. And, you know, I hugged Amber and said, hey, I'll call you when I get off the river, you know?
This time, Dan did actually call her. So while Dan knew he wanted to be with Amber for the rest of his life, love doesn't pay the bills. So he needed to figure out what he wanted to do.
Yeah, I got an acceptance letter from UAA.
That's University of Alaska Anchorage.
That said I've been conditionally accepted into the Masters of Social Work program, but it was conditional upon getting a B or better in these two prerequisite classes. And so one of them was like, okay, yeah, I could do that. But the other one was statistics.
Like the hardest thing you could think of.
Thinking about, you know, the bell curves, right?
Yeah.
Or histograms, all this stuff. I'm like, is that going to work?
It seems so visual.
I mean, going back to school all when you've been out of school is a very hard transition, I feel. But then you had to relearn how to learn without sight.
Very much so.
Yeah, even just like picking apart equations.
Right. The long statistical equations. Yeah. It was very daunting. First things first, right? So for me, the first challenge, which was not insignificant, is, okay, first of all, I got to get from my house to a bus stop, on the right bus, to the campus. And then I got to figure out how to navigate this entire college campus to the right building. Then I have to find the right classrooms. Then I have to find a desk to sit in without sitting on somebody else's lap, right?
Like, yeah.
And so, like, in my mind, like, that was the first order of events of, like, okay, this is the first challenge of school to solve and figure out. So I literally practiced for, like, 3 weeks leading up to the first day of classes. So, like, yeah, just practicing that whole route from my house. Well, so I go into school on the first day of classes, and I walk into class only to discover that they had reassigned the classroom.
Cool. Great.
So I was not in the right place. I have been in engineering class. So that first day, they helped me. One of the students that was there, you know, helped me find the classroom I needed to get to. So I was like, okay, that's fine. Then my second sort of challenge and fear was sort of actualized, which was that for statistics, especially, I mean, this is back in the day of overhead projectors, you know?
Uh-huh.
Where they're literally writing with markers on the transparent sheets and it's all projected on the board. Yeah. So the teacher was just walking through these long statistical equations on the overhead projector and walking through it kind of step by step. This is how you do it. And I wasn't able to learn that way.
Yeah.
So I was sitting in class not learning statistics. And pretty much by like the second or third, maybe fourth class, like I was pretty much sitting there acknowledging that I'm not learning statistics, and I was having pretty significant panic attacks, like in class even. And so my experience was I'd be sitting there, my heart would start pounding, like to where I was like, oh, I'm near the base. Somebody could even see my shirt moving, and my legs and arms would kind of feel wobbly. So when it was that hard, like just being there was so hard because of these panic attacks and stuff. Like, I thought really long and hard about, like, should I just get up and walk out in the middle of class and go home and crawl back into bed and just tell people, like, hey, I tried it. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I knew that nobody would be mad at me. Nobody would judge me. Like, I was taking on this enormous challenge with a new disability. I knew that it would be, people would be fine with it. But I thought about, like, the implications. Like, I thought about, first of all the people who had supported me. I thought about how many people said, Dan, if anybody can do this, you can do this. I thought about my parents. I thought about, and most of all, I thought about Amber, right?
Yeah.
What would it be like to tell Amber? And what would that mean for my life? Like, so anyway, I decided that what I needed to do was to get a tutor. And so I went to disability support services there at the university after class one day and talked to them about getting a tutor to help me learn how to do statistics on my own. Got hooked up with a really cool guy who kind of, I think he liked the challenge and liked this idea, this project, you know, of helping me. And when I needed more, I actually got a second tutor. And so I was working with the two tutors. Amber was also helping me sometimes in the evenings and weekends when she wasn't at work. You know, I started to learn how to do statistics. And I had a computer with talking software that I could kind of, like, on each line kind of show my work step by step. I had a voice memo recorder that I would listen to the actual equations on my computer. And then I would record them into my voice memo. Not in their given order, but in the order of operations.
Right.
To help me track how I needed to do things. And then I had a talking calculator. So I was figuring it out. I figured it out. And, you know, with a lot of help, with a lot of support. And It was just such an amazing thing when, at the end of the semester, when the grades posted that I needed to be or better, but somehow I had managed to pull off getting an A in statistics.
I mean, I couldn't get an A in statistics.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I can't, honestly, it was just such a good feeling because I knew that if I could figure out statistics, if I could be successful with that, that I would be able to figure out, you know, my social work classes.
Yeah.
So, sure enough, with a lot of help and a lot of support from a lot of folks, including my cohort in grad school, and obviously Amber, but also some really good teachers, that I was able to, you know, complete my master's in social work and graduate and walk the stage. And actually, got a 4.0 in my master's program and went on shortly thereafter to start here at Denali Family Services as a therapist working with kids. And I think as I worked my way through, you know, starting with statistics, as a result of those successes and kind of building on those successes, the narratives definitely started to shift to less of I don't know if I could do this about things, but more so no, I know I can figure this out.
Dan worked his way up and is now the president and CEO of Denali Family Services. As for him and Amber.
So Amber and I obviously got married back in 2006. So a few years after the bear. And we're still together today. We've this summer in July, this coming summer, will be our 20th anniversary of marriage. So that's
congrats.
Really exciting. Yeah, for sure. By far the best thing that ever happened to me, her being in my life. And our kids are now 16 and 18. So I have a 16-year-old daughter and an 18-year-old son. They're both awesome. They're both really good kids. But as they grew up, you know, with a blind dad, obviously life was a little different for them in ways that they didn't understand or realize, right?
Yeah.
It's funny talking to my daughter now. She tells me that when she grew up, she thought other people's dads were different.
Sure. Well, yeah, you're normal.
Yeah.
Because exactly. You're her dad. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So kind of an interesting, experience. But, it was the type of thing where, as the responsible adult, as the parent, yes, it's my job to provide supervision and change diapers, and feed you and to bounce you when you're, you know, and hold you when you're fussy and to get you to sleep when it's time to sleep and all those things. And I figured out, you know, you could figure out how to do all those things. But at the same time, it's a regular thing in my household to be hey, Acacia, could you help me find my shoes? You know?
Sure.
So it was much more of this teamwork thing relationship that I had with my kids, where it's I'm going to be here for you and provide all the things that you need, but also you're also a part of this team that needs to contribute for this all to work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so kind of a neat relationship that I think, you know, and as a result, I think both my kids, they kind of grew up internalizing that sense of being part of a team.
And this sense of community and helping those around you has given Dan light after being plunged into the darkness. God, that was a very cheesy line, but it's true.
It's almost like there's this inverse and proportional relationship between engaging and disability.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that the more engaged you are, the less disabled you are.
Yeah.
And yet, for any of us, I mean, certainly for me, you know, somebody who became blind in an instant and then had to refigure out how to live life, it would have been easy for me to disengage from living fully, right?
Yeah.
Because it's scary. I was having panic attacks and anxiety. And it's much easier to not go out and brave the world and not take those risks and chances and not go to grad school and not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Much easier just to stay home and be disabled, right?
Yeah. Just if I don't try, I'm not going to get hurt.
And that's it. And that's where, you know, part of my thing is like, hey, everybody has a bear in their lives, right?
Yeah.
And so, because the truth is, it could be a car accident, it could be a divorce, it could be a substance use issue, it could be so many, it could be anything, mental health challenges. But there's many things in life that cause people to disengage, right? To take that step back, to stop living fully, to stop engaging to some extent. And it is a matter of degree. And that's why I say that there's like this inverse and proportional relationship between engaging in life and disability. So anything that might cause somebody to stop living fully, it sort of like increases that disability side of things.
Yeah.
And so anyway, in kind of summarizing the whole thing, like what's my biggest takeaway from this? It's that the more I've engaged in life, the bigger my life has become. And the bigger my life, the smaller my disability.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoy today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.